This is episode 14 of the Commitment to Excellence podcast. I'm Sean Quimby, I'm your host. Today we are going to talk about mindset. I feel like this has been a long time coming because I've been planning this episode for the last 3 or 4 weeks, and I have been very sick and I've punted for several weeks, so I'm still a little bit sick, but I'm not too sick to dive in and take a crack at this today. So here we go. Thanks for joining me. As always, I want to thank folks for the downloads and the shares, especially the shares. That is the biggest thing that you can do. Share the episode, get the word out. If you're enjoying this and getting any benefit from this, and I'm still getting pretty positive feedback, which is great. It's just encouraging me to keep going. I really appreciate everybody, especially the last couple of weeks, bearing with me being sick and just kind of conjuring up sort of random episodes that have gone well, I guess. So I'm appreciative, but share the show. Hit up the Facebook group, Commitment to Excellence. There's not much going on there, but someday there will be. Commitment to Excellence, Instagram page. Those are good ways to connect, and you can always email me, quimbycc@gmail.com. Best way currently to get a hold of me. If anybody has ideas or feedback, I appreciate it. Thanks for listening. I appreciate it. So here we go today, mindset. We're going to talk about mindset, specifically focusing on the book by that name, Mindset, by Dr. Carol Dweck. Carol Dweck's a psychologist. She's a research psychologist professor at a university. When she wrote the book, I believe she was at Columbia, PhD psychologist professor at Columbia. She's at Stanford now. And she has spent, from what I gather, the bulk of her career looking at mindset and thinking and problem solving and the differences between what she calls a growth mindset and a fixed mindset. And those are kind of obvious principles if you think about them, right? A growth mindset is like somebody who embraces change and someone who embraces challenges and someone who embraces opportunities and is kind of, you know, a glass half full kind of person, right? It's opportunity to grow and move forward, and I like the challenges. And someone with a fixed mindset is more inclined to just be like, things are the way they are. I'll do as good as I will because I have a fixed intelligence and fixed skill set, and you're just kind of born with certain abilities. And the research just doesn't really support that in any area. Sure, you know, we're all born with an IQ range, if you will, an intelligence range. And the vast majority of us are all kind of in that average range, right? We're all playing with the same deck of cards for the most part. But yet, that's not the outcomes. There are tremendous numbers of people that are high achievers that aren't geniuses or don't have exceptionally above average IQs. They have average IQs, but they do above average things. And what are the differences between maybe the underachievers and the overachievers? And in this podcast, The Commitment to Excellence, you're going to repeatedly hear some similar things. Now, Dr. Dweck comes at it from a slightly different angle. She's just looking at mindset. And you might be thinking, well, you're just kind of born that way, right? Like, we're all inherently born with certain personality characteristics. We trend towards, you know, introversion, extroversion, right? Like, I'm outgoing, I'm quiet. Quiet, reserved people are introverted. Outgoing, you know, kind of louder people, extroverted, right? I am a pretty strong introvert. Over the years, I have moved myself more, like, I still wouldn't say I'm an extrovert, but there was a time, if you're thinking about a continuum, I was way on the introvert side. Now I'm probably in the middle, maybe even just a hair over towards the extrovert side. I don't know. But here's what I know. I've changed over time because I chose to. I felt like I needed to accomplish some of the things that I wanted to accomplish. And that's where I feel like I've exhibited a growth mindset. And personality characteristics, natural skill sets and abilities, they're all, there's a range there that you have, even with your IQ, right? Like, I have a range of IQ that I get to play with, and I get to decide whether or not I'm going to maximize that range or I'm going to minimize that range. And what will make that determination? What makes that determination is the effort that I put in, the reps that I get in everything, in sports and athletics. Sure, Michael Jordan and Kobe Bryant and Tiger Woods, they all had exceptional abilities. But I guarantee you that there are people that have been born on this earth that had more natural, inherent physical abilities than them. But they didn't put in the work. They didn't engage in the deliberate practice. People that think that way tend to have a growth mindset. And, you know, growth mindset is not, it's not fixed. It's not specific. So there are areas in my life that I trend towards a fixed mindset. I know that's not helpful, but there are certain things where I'm just like, well, this is the way that it is, or I have this ability, or I'm, you know, these are stories that we tell ourselves, right? Things are a certain way. Well, I've always been overweight, so I have to be overweight my entire life. That is a story that I tell myself, and I, you know, I fight against it, but it's a script that I have. You know, I can change that script if I want to. It's about effort and reps and deliberate practice, and that's a fixed mindset thing. Her research is all about the advantages and disadvantages of having a growth mindset versus a fixed mindset. So I want to talk a little bit about the book. There'll be a link in the show notes if you want to go check it out. I actually was just looking. I have an old, there's an updated version of it that I actually ordered the other day just so I can make sure I have the correct current research. Dr. DeWitt's still publishing. I'm just looking at some of the papers she's most recently published. Growth Mindset, Tempers the Effects of Poverty on Academic Achievement, Teaching a Lay Theory Before College Narrows Achievement Gaps at Scale, What Predicts Children's Fixed Growth, Intelligence Mindsets, Not Their Parents' Views on Intelligence, But Their Parents' Views on Failures. That's some really interesting stuff. Anyways, it's just gobs of papers that she's written and published and been a part of. But this book is a pretty foundational summary of her research and others like it. So I'm going to kind of do a book review here again today. And I'm going to read some excerpts from the book and kind of talk and share a little bit. Just an overview. Like, I don't want to read the whole book to anybody. I want to try to keep podcasts, yeah, I'm really shooting to keep them under an hour. That's where the feedback that I've got is that people like kind of that 45 minute ish range. So at least for the time being, that's where I'm trying to keep things. So I'm not going to read the whole book, obviously, but hopefully you'll learn some things and maybe you'll want to go out and get it. And I think reading is a really valuable tool. It's funny, I've mentioned before, I hated to read when I was a kid growing up. Now I wish I had more time to read. And I think, you know, I think reading helps fuel growth mindsets, really. So from the introduction, in this book, you'll learn how a simple belief about yourself, a belief we discovered in our research, guides a large part of your life. In fact, it permeates every part of your life. Much of what you think of as your personality actually grows out of this mindset. Much of what may be preventing you from fulfilling your potential grows out of it. No book has ever explained this mindset and shown people how to make use of it in their lives. You'll suddenly understand the greats in the science and arts and sports and in business and the world have been. You'll understand your mate, your boss, your friends, your kids. You'll see how to unleash your potential and your children's. So I'm just going to hit some sections here. what she does a lot in this book is she'll talk a little bit about facts and then she'll share a story or a perspective. And I'm not going to there's lots of examples from athletes and students, children that she's worked with over the years, CEOs, business people, people like that. So I'm not going to read a lot of the stories, but like they all illustrate the concepts. And I like books that do that, that, you know, talk about concepts, use examples, come back to concepts. So I'm going to focus more so on the concepts parts, and you can fill in the blanks if you like. Here she goes, chapter one. When I was a young researcher, just starting out, something happened that changed my life. I was obsessed with understanding how people cope with failures and how I decided to study it by watching how students grapple with hard problems. So I brought children, one at a time, to a room in their school, made them comfortable, gave them a series of puzzles to solve. The first ones were fairly easy, but the next ones were hard. As students grunted, perspired, and toiled, I watched their strategies and probed what they were thinking and feeling. I expected differences among children and how they cope with the difficulty, but I saw something I never expected. Confronted with the hard puzzles, one 10-year-old boy pulled up his chair, rubbed his hands together, smacked his lips, and cried out, "I love a challenge." Another, sweating away on the puzzles, looked up with a pleased expression and said with authority, "You know, I was hoping this would be informative." What's wrong with them, I wondered. I always thought you coped with failure or you didn't cope with failure. I never thought anyone loved failure. Were these alien children or were they on to something? Everyone has a role model, someone who pointed the way at a critical moment in their lives. These children were my role models. They obviously knew something I didn't, and I was determined to figure out, to understand the kind of mindset that could turn a failure into a gift. What did they know? They knew that human qualities, such as intellectual skills, could be cultivated through effort, and that's what they were doing, getting smarter. Not only weren't they discouraged by failure, they didn't even think they were failing. They thought they were learning. I, on the other hand, thought human qualities were carved in stone. You were smart or you weren't. And failure meant you weren't. It was that simple. If you could arrange successes and avoid failures at all costs, you could stay smart. Struggles, mistakes, perseverance were just not part of the picture. Whether human qualities are the things that can be cultivated or things that are carved in stone is an old issue. What these beliefs mean for you is a new one. What are the consequences of thinking that your intelligence or personality is something you can develop as opposed to something that is fixed? Deep-seated trait. Let's first look at the old age, fiercely waged debate about human nature and then return to the question of what these beliefs mean for you. Since the dawn of time, people have thought differently, acted differently, and fared differently from each other. It was guaranteed that someone would ask the question of why people differed, why some people are smarter or more moral, and whether there was something that made them permanently different. Experts lined up on both sides. Some claimed that there was a strong physical bias for these differences, making them unavoidable and unalterable. Through the ages, these alleged physical differences have included bumps on the skull, phrenology, the size and shape of the skull, craniology, and today, genes. Others pointed to the strong differences in people's background, experiences, training, or ways of learning. It may be a surprise to know that a big champion of this view was Alfred Binet, the inventor of the IQ test. Was the IQ test meant to summarize children's unchangeable intelligence? In fact, no. Binet, a Frenchman working in Paris in the early 20th century, designed this test to identify children who were not profiting from Paris public schools, so that new educational programs could be designed to get them back on track. Without denying individual differences in children's intellects, he believed that the education and practice could bring about fundamental changes in intelligence. Here is a quote from one of his major works. "A few modern philosophies assert that an individual's intelligence is a fixed quantity, a quantity which cannot be increased. We must protest and react against this brutal permission. With practice, training, and above all method, we manage to increase our attention, our memory, our judgment, and literally to become more intelligent than we were before." Skipping ahead a little bit. "At the same time, scientists are learning that people have more capacity for lifelong learning and brain development than they ever thought. Of course, each person has a unique genetic endowment. People may start with different temperaments and different aptitudes, but it's clear that the experience, training, and personal effort take them the rest of the way." Robert Sternberg, the present-day guru of intelligence, writes that the major factor in whether people achieve expertise is not some fixed prior ability, but purposeful engagement, deliberate practice. That's my words. Or, as his former Binet recognized, it's not always the people who start out the smartest who end up the smartest. So we're talking about people who do the most with the potential that they have. Reps, hard work. That's what makes the difference. Skipping ahead a little bit here. "The other thing exceptional people seem to have is a special talent for converting life setbacks into future successes. Creativity researchers, in a poll of 143 creativity researchers, there was wide agreement about the number one ingredient ingredient in creative achievement. And it was exactly the kind of perseverance and resilience produced by the growth mindset." You might be asking again, how can one belief lead to all this? In the chapters that follow, you'll see exactly how this happens and how the mindset change what people strive for and what they see as success. How they change the definition, significance, and impact of failure, and how they change the deepest meaning of effort. You'll see how these mindsets play out in school, in sports, in the workplace, and in relationships. You'll see where they come from and how they can be changed. So here's a little question to ask yourself. Which mindset do you have? Answer these questions about intelligence. Read each statement and decide whether you mostly agree with it or disagree with it. Your intelligence is something very basic about you that you can't change very much. You can learn new things, but you can't really change how intelligent you are. No matter how much intelligence you have, you can always change it quite a bit. You can always substantially change how intelligent you are. So think about those questions. Your answers to them give you some perspective on how you think. Are you a fixed mindset person or are you a growth mindset person? Further in the book, "When you enter a mindset, you enter a new world. In one world, the world of fixed traits, success is about proving you're smart, talented, validating yourself. In the other, the world of changing qualities, it's about stretching yourself to learn something new, developing yourself. In one world, failure is about having a setback, getting a bad grade, losing a tournament, getting fired, getting rejected. It means you're not smart or talented. In the other world, failure is about not growing, not reaching for things that you value. It means you're not fulfilling your potential. In one world, effort is a bad thing. It's like failure means you're not smart or talented. If you were, you wouldn't need effort. In the other world, your effort is what makes you smart or talented. You have a choice. Mindsets are just beliefs. They're powerful beliefs, but they're just something in your mind, and you can change your mind. As you read, think about where you'd like to go, which mindset will take you there. If you read this book, you'll see a lot, or you hear her talk a lot about people with fixed mindsets seem to use those mindsets for, like, really as an excuse to be okay with failure and to be okay with a lack of success and growth. And they even talk about some high-level athletes that have fixed mindsets, that like John McEnroe, for example. She talks quite a bit about John McEnroe in here. And, you know, he was obviously a pretty successful high-level tennis player, but her contention is that his fixed mindsets and his attitude problems kept him from being anywhere near as good as he probably could have been. And that seems like that's probably true. So it's worth looking at yourself and thinking about where are your mindsets fixed and where are they not? And what are you, you know, this whole book drips to me about deliberate practice and extreme ownership. I haven't really talked much about extreme ownership yet, but we'll talk more about that. But it just, in an honest, truthful moment when I'm able to cut through my ego BS, I know that all the good things in my life happen because I've chosen for them to happen. And I also know, gut check moment here, that all the bad things in my life have happened because on some level I've chose for them to happen, or I've just not chosen to move the ball forward. And that's a, you know, when you think like that, and I try really hard to think, it is hard to do, especially in the moment. It's very hard to do, but that is maybe the ultimate growth mindset, and it's what I am striving for every day. And she doesn't talk about extreme ownership in here, but I think she's talking about extreme ownership in here. So she talks a lot about school and school achievement. And this is where, when we're young, our brains are probably even more pliable. But I'm not sure if we do a good job encouraging a growth mindset in our children. I know I didn't with our first child, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later. But I did not, and I wasn't keen to this research at the time. I wish I had been, because I think I've made some changes in my parenting approach with my younger child than I did with my older child, but that I think have been beneficial. And I mean, my oldest is not a kid anymore, but I still parent him and interact with him, and I'm trying to make a shift now, and I don't think it's too late. So here she's talking about mindset and school achievement. Getting back to the book, we measured students' mindsets as they made the transition to junior high school. Did they believe their intelligence was a fixed trait or something they could develop? Then we followed them for the next 2 years. The transition to junior high is a time of great challenge for many students. The work gets much harder. The grading policies toughen up. The teaching becomes less personalized. And all of this happens while students are coping with their new adolescent bodies and roles. Grades suffer, but not everyone's grades suffer equally. In our study, only the students with the fixed mindsets showed the decline. They showed an immediate drop-off in grades, and slowly but surely did worse and worse over the next 2 years. The students with the growth mindset showed an increase in their grades over the 2 years. When the two groups had entered junior high, their past records were indistinguishable. In the more benign environment of grade school, they'd earn the same grades and achievement test scores. Only when they hit the challenge of junior high did they begin to pull apart. Here's how students with a fixed mindset explain their poor grades. Many maligned their abilities. I'm the stupidest, or I suck in math. And many covered these feelings by blaming someone else. Not extreme ownership. The math teacher is a fat male slut. That's extreme. And the English teacher is a slob with a pink ass. These are quotes, just for the record. Because the teacher is on crack, these interesting analyses of the problems hardly provide a roadmap to future success. With the threat of failure looming, students with the growth mindset instead mobilize their resources for learning. They told us that they too sometimes felt overwhelmed, but their response was to dig in and do what it takes. They were like George Danzig. Who? George Danzig was a graduate student at Berkeley. One day, as usual, he rushed in late to his math class and quickly copied the two homework problems from the blackboard. When he later went to do them, he found them very difficult, and it took him several days of hard work to crack them open and solve them. They then turned out to not be homework problems at all. They were two famous math problems that had never been solved. So that's an interesting story. So here she's talking about something she calls the low effort syndrome. Our students with the fixed mindset were facing the hard transition and saw it as a threat. It threatened to unmask their flaws and turn them from winners into losers. In fact, in the fixed mindset, adolescence is one big test. I am smart or dumb. I am good looking or ugly. I am cool or nerdy. I'm a winner or a loser. And in the fixed mindset, being a loser is forever. It's no wonder that many adolescents mobilize their resources not for learning, but to protect their egos. And one of the main ways they do this, aside from providing vivid portraits of their teachers, is by not trying. This is when some of the brightest students simply stop working. In fact, students with the fixed mindset tell us their main goal in school, aside from looking smart, is to exert as little effort as possible. They heartily agree with statements like this. In school, my main goal is to do things as easily as possible, and I don't have to work very hard. So I would argue that's sort of a defense mechanism, right? Like if things all of a sudden start getting hard and things that were easy for you get harder, the easiest way to protect your ego and your, you know, your emotional well-being is to start to not care. And it's certainly not to work harder. But kids with a growth mindset are going to work harder as a result of challenges that they face. And that, as a parent, as a coach, as a mentor of some kind to a young person, or even to an adult, that's where you can be helpful. We'll talk more about that later. So this next section I'm skipping to, she talks about the danger of praise and positive labels. And I'll just like to summarize this. Praise is not the problem. Praise is good, obviously. Positive reinforcement is what you want. You want to provide positive feedback to increase a behavior. The moral of the story is, what are you providing that positive reinforcement for? So she would argue, and I'll go into a side story here, is that you don't praise inherent natural ability. Mistake I made with my son when my son was little, or he was in grade school, he had some stuff going on, and we were trying to figure out how to best help him out with it. We ended up having, he had some psychological, intellectual testing done, basically. And we were trying to figure out kind of how best to teach him and help him learn. And we kind of thought, we're like, hey, like, he's pretty smart. Maybe we're not giving him enough. So it turns out we were right. He was pretty smart. Maybe not quite, I think I was under some early delusion that he was a genius of some kind. And he's not. But his IQ tested out well above average. So the mistake that I made from that, well, prior to that and from that point forward, was I just praised him for how smart he was. And he had some really like special abilities in terms of visual spatial stuff, and he kind of tested off the chart in that area. So, you know, I was hoping at that point, all right, cool, he's going to be an engineer. Well, no, he's more into the arts and film and that kind of stuff, visual spatial stuff though, right? So it sort of makes sense. But my mistake as his parent was, at that point, I just, like, I praised how smart he was. And that meant things were supposed to come easy to him. I never praised his work ethic. And one of my biggest criticisms of him maybe to this day is that, you know, I just don't, sometimes I think he doesn't work as hard as he could. He's maybe not as organized as he could be. I think that was where I failed him as a parent. I've learned these lessons and adjusted. It is rare with my daughter. It's rare that I praise anything that looks like her natural ability. Of course, every once in a while I do, because it's fun and it's cool and it feels good for her and it feels good for me because she's got plenty of natural abilities. But what I praise is her work ethic. I praise how hard she is. I praise how her courage and her ability to stretch. If you listen to, I think it was episode 9 that I did with her, that's why I did that episode with her. It was an opportunity for me. And, you know, I didn't focus on her natural ability. I focused on her work ethic and how hard she works and how she's brave and stretches outside of her comfort zone. That's all growth mindset stuff. And I'm, you know, like, I've just sort of programmed myself to think that way more because it's good for me. But it's good for her as a parent for me to give her that. So that's, you know, I'm summarizing here just for the sake of time. That's a lot about what this, what she sees in terms of in school praising kids for their work ethic and their the skills where they have to deliberately engage in things, where they stretch outside of their comfort zone. And, you know, this doesn't have to just be with kids. It can be what we do with each other. It can be with what we do with people that we supervise. It's a little harder with grown-ups probably and a little easier to see and point out in children and adolescents. But it's how that's the kind of praise that we should be giving to people. There's a section on leadership. So we're moving through the book here. Are leaders born or made? When Warren Bennis interviewed great leaders, they all agree that leaders are made, not born, and made more by themselves than by any external means. Bennis concurred, "I believe that everyone of whatever age and circumstance is capable of self-transformation. Not that everyone will become a leader. Sadly, most managers and even CEOs become bosses, not leaders. They wield power instead of transforming themselves, their workers, and their organizations." Why is this? John Senegar and Joseph Folkman point out that most people, when they first become managers, enter a period of great learning. They get lots of training and coaching. They're open to ideas and they think long and hard about how they do their jobs. They're looking to develop, but once they've learned the basics, they stop trying to improve. It may seem like too much trouble, or they may not see where improvement will take them. They are content to do their jobs rather than making themselves into leaders. So thinking back to our 5 levels of leadership, you know, where are those people at? They're not level 4 and level 5 leaders, probably. Level 4 and level 5 leaders keep growing over time. So here is a little more about growing your mindset in the book. Are you in a fixed mindset or growth mindset workplace? Do you feel like people are just judging you, or are they helping you develop? Maybe you could try making it more growth mindset place, starting with yourself. Are there ways you could be less defensive about your mistakes? Could you profit more from the feedback that you get? Are there ways that you can create more learning of experiences for yourself? So she's talking here, I would argue, about being a level 4, level 5 leader. She's also talking about extreme ownership. She's just not saying it. Get to that. That's another book coming up soon. Maybe the next one I do. We'll see. How do you act towards others in your workplace? Are you a fixed mindset boss focused on your power more than your employees' well-being? Do you even reaffirm your status by demeaning others? That's a level 1 leader. Do you even try to hold back, or do you ever try to hold back high-performing employees because they threaten you? Level 1 leader. Consider ways to help your employees develop on the job: apprenticeships, workshops, coaching sessions. Think about how you can start seeing and treating your employees as your collaborators, as a team. Make a list of strategies. And she goes on, more of the same. So here's some more about parents, teachers, and coaches. Where do mindsets come from? No parent thinks, "I wonder what I can do today to undermine my child, subvert their effort, turn them off to learning." and limit their achievement. Of course not, they think. I would do anything, give anything to make my children successful. Yet many of the things they do boomerang. Their helpful judgments, their lessons, their motivating techniques often send the wrong message. This is what I was talking about a few minutes ago. In fact, every word and action can send a message. It tells children or students or athletes how to think about themselves. It can be a fixed mindset message that says, you have permanent traits and I am judging them. Or it can be a growth mindset message that says, you are a developing person and I am interested in your development. It's remarkable how sensitive children are to those messages and how concerned they are about them. Chaim Gnat, the child-rearing sage of the 1950s through 70s, tells us this story. Bruce, age 5, went with his mother to his new kindergarten. When they arrived, Bruce looked at the paintings on the wall and said, "Who made these ugly pictures?" His mother rushed to correct him. It's not nice to call pictures ugly when they are so pretty. But his teacher knew exactly what he meant. "In here," she said, "you don't have to paint pretty pictures. You can paint mean pictures if you like." Bruce gave her a big smile. She had answered his real question, what happens to a boy who doesn't paint well? Next, Bruce spotted a broken fire engine. He picked it up and asked in a self-righteous tone, "Who broke this fire engine?" Again, his mother rushed in. "What difference does it make who broke it? You don't know anyone here." But the teacher understood. "Toys are for playing," she told him. "Sometimes they get broken. It happens." Again, this question was answered. What happens to boys who break toys? Bruce waved to his mother and went off to start his first day of kindergarten. This was not a place where he would be judged and labeled. You know, we never outgrow our sensitivity to these messages. Several years ago, my husband and I spent 2 weeks in Provence in the south of France. Everyone was wonderful to us, kind and very generous, but on the last day we drove to Italy for lunch. When we got there and found a little family restaurant, tears started streaming down my face. I felt so nurtured, I said, "David, you know, in France, when they were nice to you, you feel like you've passed the test. But in Italy, there is no test. Parents and teachers who send fixed mindset messages are like France. And parents and teachers who send growth mindset messages are like Italy." That makes a ton of sense to me. Let's start with the messages parents send to their children. So more of what I was talking about before. What are you praising? How are you helping them deal with adversity? Here's a little more about that. Does this mean we can't praise our children enthusiastically when they do something great? Should we try to restrain our admiration for their successes? Not at all. It just means that we should keep away from a certain kind of praise. Praise that judges their intelligence or talent, or praise that implies we're proud of them for their intelligence or talent, rather than for the work they put in. Side, but my daughter has I got my daughter a necklace. She wanted, when she can, she likes the number 26 is her favorite number. She likes to wear that on her sports uniforms, and she's all excited. Her travel ball, softball uniforms, 26 this year. Last year it was 6. So 26 this year. So I bought her a necklace a couple of years ago. It just has 26 on it. And you can have something engraved on it. And I make this joke with her. She thinks I'm a dork because I talk about hashtags and that kind of thing, like my Burning Daylight hashtag. Well, I also like the HWPO hashtag, which is short for Hard Work Pays Off. I had that engraved on the back of her necklace. I wanted to remember that hard work will make the difference. How much effort you put in, how much deliberate practice you put in, will decide how amazing you are at anything. And that's a mindset thing. More from the book. We can praise them as much as we want for the growth-oriented process, what they accomplish through this practice, study, persistence, and good strategies. And we can ask them about their work in a way that admires and appreciates their efforts and choices. You really studied for your test and your improvement shows. You read the material over 7 times, you outlined it, and you tested yourself on it. It really worked. I like the way you tried all kinds of strategies on that math problem until you finally got it. You thought of a lot of different ways to do it and found the one that worked. So messages about failures. Praising success should be the least of our problems, right? Failure seems like a much more delicate matter. Children may already feel discouraged and vulnerable. Let's tune it again. This time to the messages parents can send in times of failure. So here's a little story about 9-year-old Elizabeth. She was on her way to her first gymnastics meet. Lanky, flexible, and energetic, she was just right for gymnastics and she loved it. Of course, she was a little nervous about competing, but she was good at gymnastics and felt confident of doing well. She had even thought about the perfect place in her room to hang the ribbon she would win. In the first meet, the floor exercises, Elizabeth went first. Although she did a nice job, the scoring changed after the first few girls, and she lost. Elizabeth also did well in the other events, but not well enough to win. By the end of the evening, she had received no ribbons and was devastated. What would you tell Elizabeth if you were parents? So here's a couple of choices. Tell Elizabeth you thought she was the best. Tell her she was robbed of a ribbon that was rightfully hers. Reassure her that gymnastics is not that important. Tell her she has the ability and will surely win next time. Tell her she didn't deserve to win. There's a strong message in our society about how to boost children's self-esteem, and a main part of that message is protect them from failure. While this may help with the immediate problem, a child's disappointment, it can be harmful in the long run. Why? Let's look at the 5 possible reactions from a mindset point of view and listen to the messages. The first, you thought she was the best, is basically insincere. She was not the best, you know it, and she does too. This offers her no recipe for how to recover or how to improve. The second, she was robbed, places blame on others. This is not extreme ownership. When in fact the problem was mostly with her performance, not the judges. Do you want her to grow up blaming others for her deficiencies? You do not, is the answer to that question. Third, reassure her that gymnastic doesn't really matter, teaches her to devalue something if she isn't doing well in the right way. Is this really the message you want to send? No, it isn't. The fourth, she has the ability may be the most dangerous message of all. Does ability automatically take you where you want to go? If Elizabeth didn't win this meet, why should she win the next one? The last option, tell her she didn't deserve to win, seems half-hearted under the circumstances, and of course you wouldn't say it quite that way, but that's pretty much what her growth-minded father told her. Here's what he actually said. Elizabeth, I know how you feel. It's disappointing to have your hopes up and to perform your best, but not to win. But, you know, you haven't really earned it yet. There were many girls there who've been in gymnastics longer than you and who've worked a lot harder than you. If this is something you really want, then it's something you really have to work for. He also let Elizabeth know that if she wanted to do gymnastics purely for fun, that was fine. But if she wants to excel in competitions, more is required. More reps, more deliberate practice. Elizabeth took this to heart, spending much more time repeating and perfecting her routines, especially the ones she was weakest in. At the next meet, there were 80 girls from all over the region. Elizabeth won 5 ribbons for the individual events and was overall champion of the competition, hauling home a giant trophy. By now, her room is so covered with awards, you can barely see the walls. In essence, her father not only told her the truth, but he also taught her how to learn from her failures and do what it takes to succeed in the future. He sympathized deeply with her disappointment, but he did not give her a phony boost that would only lead to further disappointment. So I've learned, but by doing it wrong, that you need to be delicate with the straightforward, honest answer, but you need to stay straightforward and honest. You just got to sort of be nice about it, especially if you're a middle-aged dad talking to your teenage daughter. There just seems to be something about that equation that requires a delicate hand. All right, so here's a little bit about constructive criticism. We always hear the term constructive criticism, But doesn't everyone think the criticism they give their children is constructive? Why would they give it if they didn't think it was helpful? Yet a lot of it is not helpful at all. It's full of judgment about the child. Constructive means helping the child to fix something, build a better product, or do a better job. Billy rushed through his homework, skipping several questions and answering the others in short, sloppy ways. His father hit the roof. "This is your homework. Can't you ever get it right? You are either dense or irresponsible. Which is it?" The feedback managed to question his son's intelligence and character at the same time and to imply the deficits were permanent. How could the dad have expressed his frustration and disappointment without assassinating his son's attributes? Here are some ways. "Son, it really makes me upset when you don't do a full job. When do you think you can complete this? Son, is there something you didn't understand about the assignment? Would you like me to go over it with you? Son, I feel sad when I see you missing a chance to learn. Can you think of ways to do this that would help you learn more? Son, remember, I told you how tedious things help us learn to concentrate. This one is a real challenge. This will really take all your concentration skills. Let's see if you can concentrate through this whole assignment." So there's more to the book. There's a lot of stories, a lot of anecdotes. There's a little, you know, there's some places where she dives a little bit deeper into the research, but it's not a research heavy book. Actually, I sort of wish it was a little more research specific and heavy, but the moral of the story is that mindset is changeable and something that we should be aware of, something we need to pay attention to, something that we can work to improve, just like everything else. Mindset is a skill. We are not born with, we can breathe and cry and we know we're hungry and we know we have to go to the bathroom. Like, these are things that we're just sort of inherently born, like, they're reflexes. They're not something that we think about for the most part. Other than that, everything else is a skill. Literally, everything is a skill that can be developed, that can be refined, that can be honed. Mindset is something that we can control. And when we can identify that we're operating in a fixed mindset space, or someone else helps us point that out, we can change that. You know, I've been sick the last 3 weeks and I haven't been able to do all the things that I want to do. And I have, like, the whole last year, really, frankly, like, I've just had a rough year. I've been sick. I blew up my neck. I had a minor heart problem, right? Like, I had a ton of stuff this year. And I will tell you what, I have struggled with my mindset. Like, I have felt myself feeling like a victim at times, and I haven't wanted to do things, and I've done some woe is me type stuff. And for sure, the 5 weeks where I sat in the old lady recliner in my bedroom and just watched TV, like, I had a lot of woe is me moments. But I worked really hard to not stay there mentally. And things are coming back up in my social media memories. Like, I've been kind of impressed with, like, how hard I worked to maintain my mindset. And, you know, I still have some room to grow and I've got some places that I can improve on, but I worked really hard to keep a positive, forward moving, like, not victim mentality. You can do that. You get to decide to do that. You can do this with your kids if you're lucky enough to be a parent. You can do this with your coworkers, with your friends and family. And, you know, people that have fixed mindsets and are kind of stuck there, they don't like this a lot. I've got friends and family that I've tried this stuff with at different points in time. And I'm not judging anybody, right? Like, I've not walked a mile in your shoes, so I'm not judging anybody. But when I see somebody stuck in this, you know, fixed mindset, especially if it has anything to do with, like, I'm a victim, woe is me, that, like, my patience and tolerance for that is not a lot. And, you know, if you want to be there, cool, I'll try to help a little bit, but, like, then I'm not sticking around. And, you know, I've learned this lesson sort of the hard way with someone that I really cared, or do care a lot about, that had a rough go, like a really rough go, and I know it, but they'd interact with me and they kind of, you know, my perspective was they wanted to do the woe is me victim thing and I wouldn't do it with them, and that always made them mad. So I sort of stopped talking to them. Like, I know I wasn't really there for him, but I wasn't going to be there for him in any other way than, like, hey, you got to kind of pick this up and move forward and do the best that you can with what you've got and don't be a victim. And every time I did that, it got pretty nasty. And I'm like, why am I doing this? And, you know, I am never going to do the victim thing with anybody for a long time. And, you know, if you want something like that from me, you're not getting it. And I don't want it from you. You know, I did not want that when I was sitting in that chair for 5 weeks. I didn't want that from people. I didn't want people to tell me to get up and go run a mile because, you know, all I could do some days get to the end of the driveway. But what I wanted was people saying, hey, you know what? If you can get to any of the end of the driveway, get to the end of the driveway. That is a mindset thing and you can control it. So, you know, if you like to read, I think this is a good book. I think it's eye-opening. I think it, you know, you can use it to challenge your thinking about things and identify what are some of your shortcomings. And, I'm always trying to do that. I want to help you do that too. That's my goal of this podcast, right? Like, I am committed to being the best that I can be. Every single day, I'm trying to move forward. I want you to, too. So I'm going to try to give you things that I think might be helpful to his perspective that might be helpful. I think this book's a good read. I'd pick it up and dig into it. It's worth a read. I mean, I just hit some of the highlights and some of the things that I found the most interesting. But what my hope is that you'll think about some of the stuff and try to find some ways to apply it to your life. Maybe pick up the book. There'll be a link to it in the show notes if you want to check it out. And again, you know, I think, you know, that's all I really have to say today, but I just, again, I want to say thank you. I appreciate everybody listening. I hope that this got you thinking and gives you some things to work on as we move forward together. Stay focused. Keep making a commitment to excellence. Share the show. Thanks for listening, everybody. I appreciate you.